Brembo Red, High Performance Podcast.
Welcome back to another episode of Brembo Red. This is Dan Sandberg from Brembo North America here at the LA Auto Show. And we've certainly been on high performance mode for all of you as we've been on the road for the past 4 weeks, first at SEMA in Las Vegas and now at the LA Auto Show. And over the next few episodes of Brembo Red, we'll bring you some very informative interviews from both shows with some great car guys. And to start us off, is certainly my pleasure.
Time will tell. I don't know.
We'll find
out. Too early to say. We'll find out.
Magnus Walker is here. And if you don't know Magnus, he's a fashion designer. He's a style icon. He's an auto enthusiast. He's the Porsche builder, guru, lover, collector, real estate speculator, and developer. And of course, an urban outlaw.
That's quite a mouthful. I will say, happy to be here at the LA Auto Show on the Tuesday. I guess this is the day before. Excited to see people sweeping floors and vacuuming and, looking at cars under car covers, which is often the best way to do it.
But in the Brembo Red Studio, it's quiet, cool, collected. We have refreshments and...
We're calm, cool, and collected. You know, I say sometimes you got to stop and smell the roses, so...
And you've done that in your entire life, haven't you?
Stopped and smelt the roses?
Yeah.
Well, I'm English, English rose, so... every rose has a thorn, but that's a whole different subject right there.
All right, let's go to the Porsche thing, all right? You love Porsches, and
yeah.
It started when you were really young, right?
Yeah, it's a familiar story for those that don't know. Love affair started when I was 10 years old. I carry one around with me. That's a Hot Wheels right there that's gone around the world. That's actually my car made into a Hot Wheels. But yeah, Porsche is my drug of choice. I've been around them quite a lot.
And you focused your collection on really the air-cooled era. What are the years that you've been collecting?
Well, to begin with, I'm a goal-oriented collector. The original goal was air-cooled from 64 through 73.
Right.
So I ticked that off the box. And the next collection was the early 3-liter turbo, 75, 6, and 7. I ticked that off the box. The big goal now is one of everything Porsche's ever made in a sports car. So ultimately, that's front engine, mid engine, rear engine, air and water cooled. In the Porsche world, a lot of Porsche people think, it has to be air cooled and rear engined to be a Porsche. To me, it's all about variety. I love the Vasica cooled, water cooled transaxle cars, the 924, 928, 944, 968. My current daily driver is a 1988 944 Turbo. So I like variety. I was just at the SEMA show in Vegas. With a 914, obviously mid-engined, air-cooled. I'm looking for a Cayman, which will cover the mid-engine, water-cooled thing. But to me, it's all about variety. If there's a Porsche badge on it, I'm intrigued to see how it performs. Hannah and I had the luxury of just spending a day with the new high-voltage rock and roll Porsche Taycan. We had the Turbo S, so we drove that up my favorite road.
Which How'd you like it?
It's awesome. I mean, it's really, first of all, it's really fast. Triple digit speed in the crest is pretty easy to do in that car. You're going around corners quicker than you are in other things. And speed's very deceptive in the Taycan because there's no sound. The sound that you're hearing is road noise, it's rocks, it's tire squeal, it's suspension movement, it's wind. But the sensation of speed that you're used to really is amplified with sound. For me, I don't necessarily put sound and speed together in the same sentence, because my pet peeve, in all honesty, is dudes with loud exhaust doing 20 miles an hour just barking around, but sounds like they're going fast, but they're doing 20. So to me, speed's a relative thing. If you're excited by the emotion of the journey, I was sweating in that car because, we were going pretty fast. So to me, speed doesn't have to sound loud. And I think that's what people sort of get hung up on. I say you got to adapt to the environment, to the future, and see what happens. As long as you can still get oil and gasoline, I'm still going to be driving these old antiquated analog cars that I love. But, you got to look to the future, and the future looks pretty healthy. So there's my long answer to how the Taycan performs, having spent, a day in it. It's an exciting ride, for sure.
It's going into the collection, you think?
I've never owned a new car, let alone a new Porsche. So that's what I refer to as OPP, other people's Porsches. They're great to borrow. You don't have to own them to experience in them. So,
Let's talk about that a little bit, all right?
So OPP, you get other people's Porsches?
Well, no, let's talk about your person's Porsche. But okay. Let's, you get these Porsches and then you redo them. I guess, Magnus style.
Yeah.
And you have this fashion background. Fashion or Porsches? Is there a priority for you?
They go together. I'm no longer in the fashion business. I sort of retired from it about, well, probably 7 or 8 years ago now. But, you know, to me, the two go together. It's an aesthetic thing. It's a style thing. It's a comfort thing for me. It's a way of expressing your individuality, your own personality. Every automaker has their own sort of exclusive division. Porsche has theirs, where you can come and tailor make your car to your own needs. For me, I'm just doing it myself, adding my own interpretation of elements of fashion background, but also more elements of what I call sport purpose, streetable track cars, my sort of golden era of inspiration when it comes to Porsche or any motorsports really is mid-60s to mid-70s. To me, that's sort of the golden era of what I'm excited about, and I just add elements of that into my own builds. For example, I was just at SEMA. I bought a 914 for next to nothing from my buddy Felix Holst here in LA, and my friends at Mobile One, I was doing something with Hot Wheels, and they said, hey, do you want to put a car in at SEMA? And this is 2 weeks before the SEMA show. And I've displayed cars with Mobile One 4 or 5 times there, and they're usually sort of big builds that take a long time. And I said, well, I don't have anything. And then all of a sudden I thought, wow, I just bought that 914. And I had an idea from the 914. It's a 1973 1.7 liter base model 914, and it's a silver car, and he put a yellow door on it and painted a black arrow with a half round meatball on it. And to me, I bought the car for the door. And I'd always wanted to do an art car, and I saw this car and I go, wow, it's a perfect starting point to do an art car. So Felix helped me do the car. Essentially, it was painted. There's a big arrow that goes down the hood and then a checkerboard roof, and it goes into a Union Jack that wraps around the tailgate and some stripes down the side and a few other graphics on it. But the moral to the story is we made it up as we went along with old school tape and rattle canned the car and then took it to SEMA. Took 4 days to put it together, one half a day to sort of distress it, and then it went off to SEMA. And for those that don't know, SEMA is a specialty equipment marketplace show in Las Vegas. It's the biggest sort of aftermarket car show. SEMA is all about big budget, high dollar, shiny builds. I'm taking a base model rattle can 914 that looks like an old race car that's been buried in the desert, that's sun faded and distressed, that was done in 4 days on a budget of not a lot of money. And it really stood out at SEMA. So to me, it's all about adding my own personality to the cars.
Tell me about your relationship with Porsche right now. And you definitely have the outlaw reputation in doing what you were doing with your cars. But I understand you have a pretty good relationship with Porsche now, and they're kind of looking at what you do in a little different light.
Well, it's a strange relationship that started back in 2012. What sort of put me on the map, 10-year-old fell in love with Porsche. Fast forward, moved to LA in 86, bought my first Porsche in 92, that represented for me a dream come true. And then fast forward to 2012, my Canadian beardo brother man, Tamir Moscovici, I always have to give him a shout out, because if it wasn't for Tamir, who made this little short documentary film called Urban Outlaw, I would not be here today. So this is going to be a longish answer to the Porsche question. Urban Outlaw, short documentary film, shot on a shoestring budget, came out in October 15th, 2012. About a month later, I get a gift from Porsche, and it's a big shield that this guy Chalmers Nehemiah, my buddy, sent me. And it said, congratulations on the film. Here's a little something for the garage. Porsche shield, about 22 inches tall, goes on the garage wall. About a month after that, I get a letter from Porsche, and I have to back this up. In the film Urban Outlaw, Tamir asked me a question. The question was, what do you think Porsche would think about the cars that you've built? I said, well, I'd hope 35 years later, you know, they'd sort of, you know, be smiling or something. Anyway, Porsche wrote me a letter and said, hey, we've seen the film, we've heard about your passion, we'd like to invite you to tour the factory. And this was in 2012. I eventually went in 2013 and was purely unscripted. I ended up turning up there on September 11th, which is 9/11. Mm-hmm. They give you a little sticker to get in. It said 9/11 on it. I go, wow, this is kind of coincidental. I didn't plan that. A lot of people plan to visit Porsche on a certain day so they can get, you know, pick your car up on 9/11 or 9:30 or whatever it may be. But I think ultimately Porsche realized I have one thing that you can't manufacture and put in a bottle, and that is passion for the brand. I've been a Porsche enthusiast since I was 10, right? So 42 years, I've been owning and driving Porsches for the past 27 years. I've never owned a new Porsche, but I think what they realized was my relatability is passion for the brand. I say we all speak Porsche, it's a common language, and by that I mean is you can be in a foreign country talking to someone in a foreign language, but communicating through the car, the shared common bond, the knowledge of it. So My relationship with Porsche is interesting because I'm not an official ambassador. I'm not affiliated with them in any official way, but they just keep inviting me to do cool things such as old-timer GP at the Nürburgring, or, you know, drove across Australia with them last year. And, you know, I've gone to all these sort of bucket list places and driven cool cars. And, you know, the journey keeps continuing. And, you know, I just pinch myself and say, hey, I don't quite know how I got in this position. I don't question it. Had the privilege to drive cars I'm not able to afford to own, such as Carrera GTs and 959s and 918s. But I think that's the great thing about Porsche, probably more so than any other mark or enthusiast club, is the shared passion for allowing you to get involved and enjoy cars that maybe you can't afford to own.
Well, Magnus, hang on one second. I want to hear more about what you're doing and how you got there. Stay with us here on Brembo Red, okay?
Right back.
All right. We'll be right back right after you listen to this.
You're listening to Brembo Red.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have arrived in Philadelphia. Local time is 3:05 p.m. and the temperature is 67 degrees. At this time, you are now free to use your cellular devices.
You know that feeling when you get to turn your phone on after the plane lands? You can have that feeling every time you drive. Make sure your cell phone is stowed away whenever you are behind the wheel.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org, a message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
Dan Sandberg back at the LA Auto Show. I have Magnus Walker here, the Porsche aficionado, and I think I'm going to call you a lifestyle expert. I think that's the best way to go with this.
I like man with a beard, but you know, I'm just stopping on by Brembo.
Let's talk about that trip to the U.S., your first trip. I was just curious when you did it. You came as a camp counselor, I saw.
Yeah, I was 19 years old. You know, I left school at 15 with two O-levels, which is not much education. Bummed around on the dole for a year or so, and then went back to college when I was 18. This was, I guess, 1985, something like that. Anyway, I saw this thing. It was like a summer exchange where you could come and work on a summer camp with kids in America. And to me, it was like, oh, this is awesome. Because I'd grown up listening to American music. I was into heavy metal. My favorite bands were Motley Crue, Guns N' Roses, you know, all this type of American music. I watched a lot of American TV shows that all revolved around cars. Dukes of Hazzard, Chips, Rockford Files, Starsky and Hutch. So I had this love of Americana, and then I found this thing called Camp America, where you come to America, you work on a summer camp for the summer, and then you got a month to tour the States. So I ended up working on a summer camp for underprivileged inner city kids just north of Detroit. So I'd never really traveled too much as a kid, certainly hadn't come to America. So, you know, I flew to New York and then got on a Trailways bus and took a bus to sort of North Michigan on a Lake Michigan near Detroit, and spent the summer working on a summer camp with inner city underprivileged kids, which was an awesome experience because it taught me to become what I call an adaptive swimmer, where it was an environment I wasn't used to. You know, I'm listening to Motley Crue and Guns N' Roses, and everyone else is listening to Run DMC and LL Cool J. So it was a culture shock, but it really sort of enabled me to sort of find my footing and adapt to the environment. I talk about adapting to the environment all the time, and I've been doing it for 32 years. So I spent the summer on this camp, got to see Detroit in the 80s, and Detroit is the Motor City. You know, at the time, it didn't really occur to me for some reason. Obviously, it's a car town, right? It's a music town, Iggy and the Stooges, Motown. So it's a little bit like the environment I was from, Sheffield, a former industrial city that had fallen on hard times. So I loved it there. You know, I'm 19 years old. But the ultimate goal was to get to L.A. So took a Trailways bus from Detroit to L.A., which didn't go in a straight line. It went down through Memphis and Tulsa, Oklahoma. So that was my first American road trip on the back of a Trailways bus on like a, I don't even know how much it cost.
It's a great way to see a country,
yeah,
though, isn't it?
And the amazing thing was I arrived in L.A. at Union Station, not too far from where we are now, at like 4 a.m., fell asleep on a bench, got woken up by a cop at like 6 a.m. who said, you can't be sleeping here. And my vision of L.A. that I'd seen in the movies and TV shows was not like Union Station at 4 a.m. on a morning. I'm like, we're all the rock stars. We're all the movie stars. So it was a rude awakening, a welcome to L.A., and I've essentially been in L.A. ever since for the past 33 years. So 19 years of my life spent in Sheffield and 33 years spent in L.A. I just became a U.S. citizen last year. So it's kind of like a dream come true for me. I mean, L.A. really is home, and what I love about L.A. is the opportunity to do whatever you want to do. There's a possibility to do it here. You know, whether you want to be a movie star, rock star, supermodel, car designer, beach bum, whatever, there's an opportunity to do it in LA, and a welcoming spirit and the infrastructure to do that that doesn't exist or didn't exist where I was from in Sheffield, England, you know, 30 odd years ago. So I consider myself an Angeleno, and it's just kind of, it's a magical place to be, LA. You know, we travel all around the world, but there's something great about coming back to LA and just getting in your car and going driving. And you can do this unique trifecta of ocean, desert, mountain in one day. People talk about that. I once did it in a morning in 277. I drove from LA downtown to Santa Monica. I did it backwards. I did the ocean first. I left Santa Monica at 7 a.m. That was a beach part. I got to Palm Springs by 8:30, which is pretty good going if you know how far that is. Went up to the cable car. That was a mountain part. And then drove to Lake Arrowhead. That was a sort of mountain desert part, and got back to downtown LA by lunchtime. I'd covered 300 miles to an ocean desert mountain, and I'd done it in 6.5 hours, stopped and took photos. I mean, I didn't swim in the ocean and I didn't ski, but I hit those destinations essentially in the morning. And that's what's great about LA and Southern California.
Let's talk about that education that you were talking about. So you're in high school, you're out of high school, or the version of it in Europe, and you go a little bit of college, and you didn't finish that. But you are you're definitely a serial entrepreneur. And do you think the fact that you weren't painted into this box during education really helped you?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I describe education two ways. Book smart, that's my sister. Like 10 O-levels, 2 O-levels, university degree, that's book smart, right? And then I'm more what you call street smart, you know, which is the entrepreneurial way. If you want something bad enough, you find a way to do it. And that comes back to LA being the perfect place to become an entrepreneur. Not that many people are really from here. It's a melting pot of everything. And there's a common thread that sort of connects the three things I've done in 33 years in LA, which essentially is fashion, property, and cars. They all have a common thread that weaves that fabric together that became my style. And essentially, that's things that I like to do and that I'm passionate about. Passion, motivation, and dedication can get you a long way. One of the cool things I did after Urban Outlaw came out in 2014 was I got asked to do a TED Talk. I didn't even know what a TED Talk was. They asked me to do one. I'm like, okay. The coolest thing about the TED Talk is I learned from it. I learned how to talk in a public environment. So remember, I'm that kid that left school at 15, no education, really. I'm doing a TED Talk at UCLA, at Royce Hall, probably in front of, I don't know, almost 1,000 people. That was an uncomfortable setting for me because I wasn't used to talking in a public environment with a bunch of intellectuals that are around me. It sort of gave me confidence to narrate my story in a shorter way and get the message across. But the best thing about the TED Talk and everything that I've done, nothing has surpassed the amount of people that have seen the TED Talk. And probably 95% of them had no idea who I were and weren't car people. But the common bond from all the emails and response I get from the TED Talk is, hey, we loved your story and it inspired me to go do something I really want to do. A lot of people have an education, they go to college, they get in college debt, and then they end up in a job that they're not really happy in. But they're on this programmed fast track they're on a programmed track of where do you see yourself in 5, 10, 15, 20 years. When people ask me that at school, I'm like, I have no idea. I still don't know where I'm going to be. I know where I'm going to be next week. I know where I'm going to be until Christmas. But after that, I don't know where I'm going to be. And in a way, that sort of represents freedom to try opportunities and different things out of this box. You talk about a box. Well, I was never really boxed in. For me, the best thing I ever did was come to America. Because no one ever told me, cut your hair and get a real job in LA. But I heard that in Sheffield, cut your hair, get a real job. You'll never get a job looking like that. And I don't think I've ever really had a job, so to speak, because I've never really worked for anybody other than as a day laborer. I've never had a corporate job. So I've never been boxed into this parameters of you have to do something a certain way. And that's kind of freeing in a sense because, yeah, you make your own mistakes and maybe, you know, it takes you a little longer to get to where you're going. So for me, that is freedom of not being boxed in, you know. You come to a fork in the road, you can go left, right, or straight. You don't necessarily know where that's taking you. So, you know, to me, that is my story on being street smart. And I think my story is an LA story. I don't think it would have happened in any other city in the world. Where there's a will, there's a way. The kind of, I guess, the British bulldog tenacious spirit. And also asking for help along the way. But never really questioning or, you know, I'm not the person, even in my car builds, I never ask people's opinions. What do you think I should do, right? You know, it either feels right or it doesn't. I bought a building in the Arts District in downtown 20 years ago. People thought we were crazy when we did that, but at the time it felt right. If I'd never bought that building, I never got in the film location business. Film location business afforded me the opportunity to own more Porsches than I ever thought I would own. It's a step that I took, but I didn't know where it was going to get me. But 20 years later, people go, wow, you were so smart. We weren't smart. We just, it felt right, and we didn't overthink it. So sometimes less is more, unlike my answer to your question.
It really is a fascinating story. What's next for Magnus Walker in the near future? Can you tell us about a project you're working on coming up?
You know, for me, I think what's next is what I've always done. Just keep finding things that inspire me to create and enjoy the most out of life. Hannah and I are doing a lot of travel, driving some cool cars, and I'm still chasing a few cars out there and opportunities.
Well, Magnus, it really has been a pleasure. You know, I've been watching you, seeing you, reading about you, watching videos about you for probably the past 10 or 12 years, and it's great to finally have you stop by Brembo Red and spend some time with us on the podcast.
Appreciate the opportunity, and let's go see what the show has to offer. Thanks
Absolutely.
A lot.
Let's Appreciate go walk it.
Let's go walk it. Cheers.
This is Brembo Red. Dan Sandberg will be back with more exciting and maybe secret stuff having to do with the auto industry. Maybe Magnus will tell me something after. All right. Yeah, we'll be back in a couple minutes.
Getting the shave and a haircut. Oh, that was cool.
Melissa from Michigan. I work an extra part-time job serving lunch at my child's school, but I still can't afford to put food on our table.
Daniel from California. Choosing whether to pay the rent or pay to fix the car to get to work doesn't leave us with much at all. Now we can't even pay for meals.
Hunger is a story we can end. End it at feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
This is Brembo Red. Here's your host, Dan Sandberg.
Welcome back to Brembo Red. In this segment, I'm going to introduce you to a voice you may or may not recognize. It's the voice of Alan Taylor, award-winning radio and television host. Alan has pioneered the business of creating radio shows as an extension of magazine brands. This has been extremely effective for the car magazines like Car and Driver and Road and Track, as well as Popular Science, Entrepreneur Magazine, and Microsoft. Alan is an automotive expert, often seen on ABC, CBS, CNN, Fox, and NBC, and for more than 15 years has been the special guest highlighting the New York Auto Show each year on Live with Kelly. I often co-host the syndicated talk show The Drive, which Alan started several years ago, which airs over 120 radio stations across the nation, and he's a big fan of cars and, of course, Brembo. In Las Vegas this year at the SEMA show, Alan finally let me turn the tables and let me interview the master interviewer himself for the Brembo Red podcast. Here we go. This should be interesting. All right, Alan, when was the last time you were actually interviewed?
Well, I get interviewed every so often, but this particular interview, to me, is epic. Because you and I have been doing radio with me interviewing you for, I don't know, going on 10, 15 years at least, whatever it is. And now we have become, I'm just going to say it, you're one of my best pals. And to have you sitting here with my gear, which is yours, I'm looking at it, is much nicer than mine, interviewing me. Is I don't know. There's got to be a Jewish word for it I can't think of, you know?
All right. Well, let me ask you this.
I'm verklumped. I don't know.
I am going to make sure that I learned something from this interview about you that I never knew before.
Okay.
All right? And the first question I have for you, I know your dad was in radio for years. He's like 90 years old, right?
He's 91, and he is a bit of the dean of talk radio. He started doing talk radio shows in 1960 when I was born. I was born in 60. And then he's been doing it pretty continuously all the way through right up until last year because, you know, he's going to be 92 now. But, yeah, that's a long run.
And how did you get into radio?
I never wanted to be a radio guy. I did not want to be in the radio business. I wanted to be a car guy. So when John Wayne died, my dad was a big John Wayne fan, and he ended up buying John Wayne's ranch up in Oregon. I grew up in Southern California, and I went to Oregon to visit my sister. I didn't even want to move to Oregon. So I went to Oregon to visit my sister and to see this cool John Wayne ranch, and I'm watching Lawrence Welk on television because Oregon was really backwoods, right? This was 1979. I was 19 years old, and I had nothing to do. I'm watching Lawrence Welk thinking to myself, who would ever live in Oregon, right? So I left. I went back to California. I started working on exotic cars, and I ended up painting a Lamborghini Miura. And I did such a good paint job on it. A bunch of things happened with that car. Now think about this. Who lets a 20-year-old kid paint and do a color change on a 1967 Lamborghini Miura S from red to black? Who does that? A brain surgeon in Ojai, California, right? And it was like one of those things. He had seen paint jobs that I had done. I've been painting cars since I was in high school. So I paint this car. I do such a good job on it. Everybody starts coming to me at 20 years old with their exotic cars for me to paint. I was painting Porsches and Ferraris, and the Southern California Ferrari Club would bring all their little dents and things. And I would say, well, what's your bid? You know, and they would say, well, I'm thinking, you know, $400. And the guy goes, well, $4,000. I go, $4,000 is fine. I would take whatever they would pay me. So I go ahead and I started making money like it was going out of style. I work myself half to death by the time I'm almost 21. And I decide to take another vacation. I go up to Oregon again to visit my sister. And I thought, you know, I think I could do this body shop business up in Oregon, even though there wasn't near the car culture there was in Southern California. But I was looking to have, you know, a little better lifestyle. I was working myself to death. And so I decided to go ahead and make the move from California to Oregon. So I did. And again, I'm back watching Lawrence Welk because that's the only thing on television in Oregon at this time, right? And then one day on the news, I see this guy getting arrested at a wrecking yard. And I thought to myself, I know that guy. I know that wrecking yard. That guy's going to jail. That means that wrecking yard's going to be for sale. So the next day, I decided to go visit that wrecking yard to see if I could find that guy. Sure enough, there he was standing behind the counter. I said, hey, I saw you got arrested. What are you doing out of jail? He says, well, you know, this is my third time for being arrested. So, you know, I'm going to probably get 5 to 7 years and yada, yada. I said, well, what are you going to do the wrecking yard? He says, I'm going to shut it down and crush all the cars. I went, you're going to crush all these cars? I said, well, what will you get for the crush? He says, I don't know, probably $5,000. I reach into my pocket and I go, I got $5,000 right here. I will give it to you right now and you let me take over the lease. He goes, go talk to the old man across the street. I did. I went over. I bought a whole wrecking yard for $5,000. My life changed that day just because I had the curiosity to go check out that wrecking yard. About a year later, I sold half of it for $300,000. So then I started a car lot, and then I had a body shop. And then I had a body shop, a car lot, and a wrecking yard. Then I started a mechanic shop. Then I had 43 employees, and I started burnout again. So what happened was, along the way, I was asked to be a guest. Guy's standing at the counter, and he's buying a side view mirror for his Ford Escort. He says to me, hey, there's going to be $1 an hour minimum wage increase. And we know what that's like. It's still happening to us to this day. He says, what's that going to mean to you guys? Because I know you have a lot of minimum wage employees. And I said, well, what'd you pay for that mirror? He said, $25. After this minimum wage increase, it'll be $35. You're the one that's going to pay for the increase, not me. He goes, oh my gosh, I want you to be on my show. You got to come say that on my radio show. He had a weekend, you know, political talk show. I went on the talk show, and like right now, I'm taking over your show completely. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. It happens. I took over his show for an hour and talked politics and talked all of my thoughts of what's going on in the world. And the radio station manager came out and said, I want you to have your own radio show. You're fantastic. And I laughed. I thought he was joking, but he wasn't. He offered me a radio show. That's how I got into radio.
That's amazing. It's amazing. So that answers my second question, which was, were you a car guy first or a radio guy? So you really were a car guy first.
Totally.
And in the time that I've known you, I know you had the Shelby.
Yeah.
And you had the Viper.
Viper ACR.
And you just bought a Supra.
What about the Demon? You going to leave the Demon out of the whole thing?
I forgot the Dodge
got
Demon.
Got your brakes on it. Remember, I called you up and complained. What's going on?
I think
on?
They all had our brakes
yes,
on it.
I know, exactly.
But you bought the Supra, which I thought was interesting. Why did you do that?
I don't know why. I was compelled. I drove this little car at a really amazing little twisty racetrack. I don't even know where it was. And I had so much fun driving it. It just felt so good in all ways. It's got Batmobile lines to it. It's just, I don't know. It does something to me. And when you can't put the word on it, but it's just got that something. And what Dodge says, if you know, you know. And in this car, I didn't know. But when I finally did know, I know that I like it.
And you get the last one, right? Or the launch
version.
I got
the last one of the launch. I got 1,500 of 1,500 launch edition cars.
Let me ask you this. How do we get the young people into cars?
Do you know, Dan, it's an interesting thing. I think they're going to drag us in a different way.
I think we thought we had to drag them in kicking and screaming into the muscle car era. We have yet to see the hotness. But SEMA's right here. We're going to see some of the hotness that the young crowd are going to create in their imaginations, because they've been dreaming the same way we've been dreaming when we were, you and I were kids. We had Hot Rod Magazine and Motor Trend Magazine and, you know, that kind of stuff. But the dreams of today are more vibrant and they're more brilliant and they're more three-dimensional and they're more possible than they've ever been before. So us older car guys, I don't think we're going to have to really worry about getting them involved. It's happening right now in a seismic way under our feet. And we can feel the rumble. Pretty soon we're going to see the smoke coming out of the mountaintop.
That's encouraging to hear.
I do believe it.
What about gas and electric? Do you ever see Alan Taylor driving an electric car?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I think Audi has done some things that are pretty amazing. I think Porsche is about to blow us away. I think we've only seen the tip of the iceberg with that. Because what's going to happen, again, these young folks are going to show us what real hot rodders of today are.
Brembo obviously sponsors your show, but forgetting about that, you were a Brembo fan way before we started sponsoring
your
show,
gosh.
Right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, how do you not be a Brembo fan? Seriously. I mean, if you're a car guy, you have to be a Brembo fan. It makes no sense. If you're not, you literally, you know what I said about if you know, you know? That's when you know that guy's not really a true car guy, if he's not a Brembo fan. Because you have to be. You guys do the best job in the world for all considered, consumers, racers, even SUV owners. And truthfully, I convinced my wife, Jesse James, remember Monster Garage?
Sure.
He's kind of reemerging right now. I'll be talking to him this week. He gave me a set of gigantic wheels for a Lincoln Navigator that my wife had, and they had bullet heads on them. You know, it was cool looking wheels. And I put them on my wife's car, and she says, "What's wrong with my brakes?" Because when you upsize the wheels, you know, it's like adding more horsepower. You add more wheel size, you better add more braking power too. So she literally thought her brakes were failing. I had a shop put Brembo brakes on there. And my wife says, "Wow, what a difference." And whenever she gets into a car that does not have Brembos, she says to me, "You know, you can really tell a difference."
I knew there was a reason why I love your wife.
Yeah, and she's not a car person, but she can tell the difference between a car with Brembos and not. The feel of the foot gets bred into you. Once you've experienced it, it never goes away. You can't have a car that doesn't have Brembos if you want to stop the way the car should stop.
Well, Alan, I wanted to learn something about you and your past, and I did learn that today.
Maybe a little too much.
I think this interview is well overdue, but look, I really appreciate you spending some time with us. I know this is a busy week for you here at SEMA, busy week for you and me.
Well, we're going to be on stage together.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I appreciate you spending some time with us, and I appreciate your support of Brembo.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Brembo Red. Stay with us as we'll talk to Robert Bollinger, CEO of Bollinger Motors, who's releasing an electric vehicle in the hottest segment in North America, pickup trucks. It's coming up next on Brembo Red.
To protect his home and family from disaster, Steve used courage, wisdom, and his camera phone.
That should do it.
Way to go, Steve! By simply taking digital pictures of his family's important documents, Steve can always have them stored safely online, no matter when disaster strikes. Learn other simple ways to protect your home and family before a natural disaster at ready.gov. That's ready.gov. A message from FEMA and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the LA Auto Show. This is Dan Sandberg, and this is Brembo Red. And Robert Bollinger, CEO of Bollinger Motors, is in front of me right here at the LA Auto Show, along with two very, very interesting vehicles, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But first of all, I want to welcome you to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You have a very interesting career. Tell us a little bit about your career on the road on how you got here. You started as a legitimately degreed industrial engineer, right?
Industrial designer, yeah. Right. So I went to Carnegie Mellon a million years ago for industrial design. And the goal was to become a car designer and work in automotive. And then when I went out for interviews, they were all like, "You can't draw cars. You're kind of terrible." So at the car thing, but I had an industrial design degree. So it was more like how things are made and go together and stuff like that. So I went to New York City to get a job to save money to go to grad school. I was going to go to Art Center. And of course, I never saved a dime in New York City. So I started in marketing and advertising, ended up being there for like 25 years. Once I was there, I became friends with my friend John Masters, who started his own organic hair care company. He asked me to do his packaging. He couldn't pay me. He started off by giving me free haircuts, and then he made me a partner in the company. He gave me a percentage of the company because he couldn't pay me. He was doing very well, but he was like, everything had to go back into the company. So eventually, like a few years later, it was taken off, and I quit my advertising and I started helping to run the company. We sold that company in 2013 for a good amount of money. And then at that point, I was like 48 years old, and I was like, okay, what next? And I was like, that thing in the back of my head that was always there about automotive, and I was like, let's try something, right? So at that point, I was living upstate, had a cattle farm, and I put in an ad for engineers, and my first engineer, Carl, came on board. He's still with us, a chief engineer. And he and I started playing with stuff, and then it kind of grew from there, so...
All right. Well, tell us about this vehicle. All right. I'm looking at it. It's a very utilitarian looking pickup truck. And I guess I don't know what do you call the other vehicle? I guess it's a variant of the pickup truck.
Yeah, right? They're both the same vehicle from the nose to the C pillar. 2 years ago, we had the 2-door SUV. So now we have the 4-door SUV and the 4-door pickup. So they use 90% of the same components. So they're going to be produced alongside each other sometime in 2021. Will be our first deliveries. Those have the same battery, the same basically everything. Just one is 30 inches longer than the other.
So these are electric pickups. That is a real big battleground. I'm sure when you started this, it wasn't the battleground, but now you have Rivian, Tesla, Ford, GM, all targeting this market. Tell us about your vehicle and why is it different from what you think is going to come? What's unique about it?
Well, when I started this 4 years ago, we've only been doing it for 4 years now, but we've been here twice and had a couple rounds of prototypes. But back when we first started it, I knew everything was going to go, I think everyone knew things would eventually be electric one day. And so I thought, okay, when there's a Ford F-150 electric, we can't be that truck, they'll crush us, right? So from the very beginning, it was just like, what do we want in a truck? How do we make a truck as different as possible? Just throw everything in it that we want. Let's not care about the cost, which is not necessarily the smartest thing to do. And then revealed that in 2017 and had a big following. So I'm fully a big believer in everything going electric. Can't happen soon enough. And everyone who does, it just provides more and more vendors, more and more battery supply, more everything. So everyone's going to rise up. I'll get better costs. I don't have to spend the trillions of dollars. They can do it, but I'll benefit, we'll benefit. So everything was going to go that way, and I knew it. So the more distinct we can be from them, the better.
So who's the targeted audience for this vehicle?
At first, it was mostly the off-roading crowd. Like I wanted the pickup truck, actually, for how I wanted to use it on my farm back in the day. So that was the storage capabilities, the pass-through, holding 16-foot boards, 4x8 sheets of plywood, and all that kind of stuff. And then the rest of the team had a lot of off-road background. Carl actually built race trucks for a few people, hand-built race trucks. All that just came together, all the off-road capabilities. So it's kind of like these 3 or 4 different bubbles of very distinct different kind of trucks are in one. So you have the off-road capabilities, the storage capabilities, and then there's people who just want it because of the way it looks, or there's people who want it just because it's electric. So it's kind of like a multi-tool truck. So even though it's utilitarian in nature, the capabilities are twice of what's available on the road right now.
And the range is what?
200 miles is projected as 120 kilowatt hour pack. And it's also a class 3 truck, so it can hold 5,000 pounds. That's a whole other bubble that we got to throw in there. So that comes down to a lot of braking needs and stuff like that, right? Yeah, it's got a lot going on there.
Speaking of brakes, I mean,
ask me anything too technical. I have to pull in my engineers.
But it's okay. We got a couple of Brembo engineers sitting behind me, so we can fill in any gaps. But, you know, one thing I have to commend you on, and one thing I think if I were to say what's this pickup different from many pickups, is you have accounted for the fact that you could put a huge payload in these trucks.
Right.
And I know personally from looking at this brake system and where it came from, it definitely can handle the load,
right?
I mean, I think one of the biggest complaints we've talked about on this podcast before is people have pickups, they load them up, they're fine when they're empty. Put a few people in there, put a whole payload full of gravel or bricks or whatever, and everybody says, oh no, they never stop. We got to be really, really careful. Yep. Yep. This thing will stop, right? Yep. It has an industrial strength.
Oh yeah, so it's engineered to a 10,001 GVWR. So it's going to come in around 5,500 pounds. So, once you've put 4,500 pounds of gravel in it, if you can somehow get 4,500 pounds of gravel in it, It'll act the same brake. It'll ride and feel the way we're doing our suspension. It'll feel the same as if it doesn't have 4,500 pounds. So, yeah, all of it has to be engineered to that higher level. Yep.
Well, let me ask you this about the industry, because we keep talking about electronics and electric vehicles and what's going to happen in these cars. What do you think the biggest impediment is for the consumer? What do they have to get over to be able to buy an electric car?
Well, they have to be made available by the people who make vehicles, right? I'm surprised that the big ones haven't had more vehicles yet. You know, Tesla's been doing it for over 10 years with great success as far as vehicle sales. I think the big guys waited until, it's all a numbers thing, right? It's all about cost. So once it gets to the point where it's affordable, but it won't become affordable until they get into it. So it's a weird catch 22.
Now, what does your truck sound like when it's on the road? Have you had people comment on that?
Yeah,
at all?
Sounds like a jet engine kind of little sound. It's more like, really? It's not like a whiny sound. It's more like a, you know, like it sounds, you'll have to come over and drive it sometime.
And top speed?
Top speed is over 100. We're probably going to limit it. It's two gears, high range and low range. It can go up to 60 miles an hour in low range. You can lock the diffs. You can disconnect the sway bars electronically. It's all-wheel drive all the time, 50-50 weight balance.
So I'm going to recommend to all of our listeners that you need to get over and look at this thing. It is a very, very unique-looking pickup truck. But at the same time, it looks like a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think because of the suspension that I see and the brakes, believe it or not, are not in the wheels. They're on the inside of the axle,
right?
Which is kind of an interesting configuration. But it looks like a lot of fun. Do you drive this every day to work?
No. Those are way too expensive to take out on the Michigan roads. No way. So they stay inside. But we did have them in Moab last week and in Colorado doing snow testing.
And where are you going to be manufacturing these?
Probably in Michigan. We're going to be announcing our manufacturing partner in a month or so.
And once again, you mentioned, I think briefly, when do they think the availability is going to be, how and when?
Yeah, you can go on our website now and make a reservation for $1,000 deposit, refundable and all that. And first deliveries will be in 2021.
One last question I have for you is what's coming up for you on a product standpoint? Can you give us a little, we like a lot of scoop here.
Yeah. A lot of people love the two-door that we showed 2 years ago. So right after these get into production, we're going to go back and make two-door versions of them.
Sounds interesting. Well, look, I appreciate you spending time.
Thank you.
You are right across from the Brembo Red booth, and we've noticed all the media and people stopping by. So there's got to be something there.
Yeah, it's been a crazy day.
Huh?
Yeah.
All right. Well, we appreciate you spending some time with us, and hope to see you soon. And I'm going to come over and see if I can get a test ride and try out this truck.
Cool. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you, Robert. We've been talking to Robert Bollinger, CEO of Bollinger Motors, who's out with a brand new electric pickup and SUV. Pretty cool vehicles. I want to thank our other guests on the Brembo podcast this month, Magnus Walker, the urban outlaw who stopped by to talk to us about Porsches, and of course the troublemaker, Alan Taylor from The Drive. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Brembo Red, and if you did, please do me a favor, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to Brembo Red. I think you'll enjoy it. Well, that's it from the LA Auto Show. Take care, everyone. We'll see you on the next episode of Brembo Red.
You've been listening to Brembo Red with your host, Dan Sandberg. Send your comments, questions, and suggestions to podcast@us.brembo.com. Brembo Red is produced and copyrighted by Brembo North America.